And I was like, see, you get it. Yeah. You get it. You are an old white guy, but you understand that. Welcome to 10 Cent Takes, the show where we dig up classic relics one issue at a time. My name is Jessica Fraser, and I'm joined by my co-host, the Viceroy of the Voice, Mike Thompson.
I like it. I've never been called the Viceroy before.
Today is your day, my friend.
I know. I'm here for it.
How are you?
A little warm. It's gone from like rainy winter to very warm spring all of a sudden. So
in a day.
In a day.
Yeah. No, true facts, though. Yeah. Well, if you are new to the show, our main episodes drop every other week and provide in-depth looks into interesting moments in comic books and how they tie into pop culture and history. But today is one of our dollar bin discoveries, mini episodes, that we do in between those deep dives. Because we spend a lot of time rooting through dollar bins at local shops looking for cool stuff. Mm-hmm. And while a lot of the issues we find are fun and weird, there may not be enough for us to do a deep dive on at the moment, but we do reserve the right to change our mind later. Each episode will feature both of us talking about one random issue we came across in the dollar bins, one that fits a theme one of us chose. This week I chose classic characters, and I just let Mike do whatever he was going to do with that prompt.
Those are my favorite kinds, though, because sometimes we come with completely different comics, and other times we come with things that are like real similar.
Or the same comic, yeah. Which has happened to us once before.
Yeah, that's true.
Although you navigated that one well, though. So with this episode, we'll talk about what that comic is, what goes on inside it, and why it's interesting. These are mini episodes that are meant to provide you with some weekly content between our more in-depth discussions about the weirder and more interesting moments of comic book history. So, Mike, what classic character did you bring around this week for us?
All right, I am going pretty old school. I brought The Shadow number 1 from DC Comics, published in November 1973. It was written by Denny O'Neill, with art by Michael William Kaluta, and nobody else is listed in the credits. And this actually holds up because Kaluta is like one of those like kind of all-encompassing artists. He's not just a penciler. But I don't know who edited it or lettered it or anything like that. So, Yeah, this was actually the first series starring the Shadow from DC Comics. Prior to this, the character had had two other series. There was one from the 40s that ran for 101 issues across 9 volumes. And then there was like a short-lived series from Archie in the 60s. So,
okay,
yeah, it was one of those things where I was like, oh, that's pretty interesting to find. So yeah. We begin the story with this like absolutely gorgeous full-page spread. The Shadow is looming over the city, and you know, you can see the train tracks and everything. It's amazing. And it's just introducing us to the Shadow right before we start the actual story of the Doom puzzle.
Oh.
Yeah. So our tale begins in a warehouse on the Brooklyn waterfront, where a mobster is buying some information from another man, but their deal is interrupted by the sinister laugh of the Shadow, where the vigilante reveals himself and then says he's there for the document. But the mobster opens fire and is subsequently gunned down. The other guy tries to make a break for it, but the Shadow just like throws the dude off the gangway to his death. Like, we are only a couple of pages in, and the Shadow already just absolutely obliterated two guys, and they're not going to be the last. So,
oh my gosh.
The Shadow grabs the piece of paper that the guy was about to sell from his lifeless hands, and then he just heads outside to the cab that was waiting for him. Inside are cab driver Shrevy and Margot Lane, both agents of the Shadow. He reveals the paper he grabbed is a coded message, and you can actually solve it. Like, you know, if you figure it out, you can figure out the cipher for it, and then solve it. And if you can't, they sit there and say, oh, like if you go to the back of the book, you can actually see what the solution is. And it's an okay cipher. It doesn't quite work. Like, I wasn't fully on board with it, but it's reasonable. Like, you know, I guess.
Okay.
So after this, the group heads to the Cobalt Club, where the Shadow is known as Lamont Cranston Identity. He places a call and gives instructions for an agent named Harry Vincent to observe a building and then report back. and across town, Harry Vincent, he literally leaves his date at his apartment after he gets the call, like with the orders, and just goes out on his assignment. It's actually very funny. Okay. He ends up sitting at a street corner just as a paddy wagon gets attacked by some gangsters, including an incredibly sinister dude in like kind of a scarecrow mask. The gang breaks a prisoner out, gets the drop on Harry, and then kidnaps him. Lamont learns about the abduction, and then we cut to the gang interrogating Harry. Things look pretty dire, but then the Shadow's laughter fills the air. He makes short work of the gang, rescues Harry, and then takes the lead gangster with him to interrogate. The interrogation scene is great. Like, it's very artistically done. I really liked it. He basically hypnotizes the dude into revealing that he'd been hired months ago to steal the plans for some kind of new naval vessel and then break out prisoners tonight. But he doesn't know who hired him, and he had one more job to do tomorrow night. It all sounds nebulous, but the Shadow declares that the pattern is revealing itself. And then, as Lamont, the Shadow visits a financier named Osgood Bamber, who talks about how they're shipping out a bunch of worn-out currency to Washington, but don't worry, it's totally safe, because only Osgood and the officials in Washington know the route that's going to be used. The Shadow gets back to his cab and tells Shrevey that everything is clear to him now. Like, okay.
You want to share with the class, buddy?
Yeah, you know. So that night, we see the army convoy loading up the currency and heading out of town. However, they are going to cross the Brooklyn Bridge, which gangsters have wired with explosives. But just before they can press the plunger to blow the dynamite, we see an autogyro descend out of the sky. And have you ever seen an autogyro? It's like an airplane body, but like with a helicopter propeller on top.
Oh, yes.
So the whole idea is that it can go not only forward because it's got a propeller in the front, but it can also go up and down vertical and all that. It's actually really cool looking.
That is cool.
It's a great image too, because there's a lot of negative space around it. So the aircraft is being piloted by Margot, which I thought was cool. And then the Shadow is riding along with her. They make quick work of the criminals, and then the Shadow gets back onto the aircraft. But Margot says that she doesn't actually see a boat waiting to receive the stolen goods. And that's when the Shadow reveals they're actually looking for a submarine. He spots the sub's periscope and then pulls a lever, which drops a bunch of depth charges out of it, and that damages the vessel and causes it to surface. And as soon as the crew comes out on deck, the Shadow drops in and beats them senseless before flying away as the police boats approach. Margot congratulates him on solving the case, but the Shadow notes he only caught the underlings and not the mastermind behind the scheme. And then we see a shadowy figure flagging down a taxi and demanding to be taken to the train station. It's actually Osgood Bamber, the financier we met earlier, but then the driver reveals himself to be the Shadow. He explains that Osgood was the only person who knew the route, and so he could be the only one who arranged for the plans to get stolen a while ago, and the submarine to be built, and the currency shipment to be sabotaged. Osgood pulls out a pistol and declares that he won't suffer the humiliation of a trial. But the Shadow declares that the weed of crime bears bitter fruit and overpowers Osgood, causing the man to shoot himself. And the final panel is this taxi whipping along the highway as the Shadow's laughter pours out of it.
That's fun.
I'm not going to lie. I loved this. It's a very pulp noir crime story. I like how they made the Shadow absolutely ruthless. And while it wasn't exactly like a mystery that the reader can solve along with the Shadow, there are enough breadcrumbs for us to follow that it makes sense when the twists are revealed. And it's like, oh, okay, now I get it. But like, most likely, I don't think the average reader would have solved this.
Okay.
I also really liked how Margot just wasn't a damsel in distress. We actually see her flying the autogyro. And at one point, she proves herself to be a pretty solid sniper.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, like it was actually really refreshing. I was very pleasantly surprised. Because before this, most of my exposure to the Shadow had been that Alec Baldwin movie, which is like decidedly mediocre. And like Penelope Ann Miller is great as Margot Lane, but also they don't give her much to work with.
Fair. That is fair.
Yeah. The real standout, though, is Kaluta's artwork. It's super stylish. There's a ton of really cinematic angles. The action is delivered just beautifully. And I actually clocked a bunch of techniques that are pretty standard these days, but weren't exactly commonplace back then. So this book is like one of those ones that's like a collector's item these days, but this is a pretty ratty copy that I found, which is probably why it was in the dollar bins. And yeah, also the Shadow murders a lot of folks for a book that was brewed by the Comic Code. I was actually really kind of surprised. Oh. Like this is pretty brutal for a book from the 70s with the Comics Code seal.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's fun though. Sounds like a good one.
I liked it. I liked it a lot, actually. But I am very curious what you brought to the table tonight.
The vibes are way different.
Oh, are they? Okay.
They're like 180 degree difference.
I'm living for it.
Because this week I have brought in Scooby-Doo, Where Are You?
Oh,
issue
man.
Number 83,
nice.
Published by DC in September 2017.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So we had two stories within this. So it was a half and half kind of a situation. The first story was called The Good, the Bad, and the Ghostly, and it's the cover story.
Okay.
It's written by Derek Fidolfs, penciled by Walter Carzon, inked by Horatio Ottolini, colored by Silvana Breeze, lettered by Saeed Temafonti.
Okay.
Edited by Rob Levin, covered by Friedolfs and Pamela Lovis. So the story is about a town, the first story is about a town that called in the mystery crew to solve the mystery of missing cattle in a small western town.
All right.
So the team get there and they immediately change into color appropriate western wear and set about trying to find answers. They very quickly are introduced to the quote-unquote ghost of the town, who just flies right by them, obviously trying to intimidate them out of town. It's a rider on a black horse in black.
Okay.
So, and yeah, we find out that this horse was stolen from a local handler named Harriet.
Mm.
So she also comments on how there aren't any other women in town. She's kind of it, and she's glad that the girls are there.
Okay.
She also gives Shaggy a gun for protection.
Oh, God. Okay.
Yeah. So that evening, Shaggy and Scooby go to the bar to find some snacks, of course, because they got the munchies, as always, like me.
Yeah.
And they're like taking shots of sarsaparilla, which I thought was very funny. And that's when the ghost appears. So they manage to get back to camp, but they notice that there's a Native American nearby. And they're instantly suspicious because racism.
Mm.
They also use the word Indian. Which, so that tells you the time frame that we're looking at. Although 2017, get that
that's
right.
Kind of weird. Yeah, like
yeah, okay. I thought so too. It was a little strange. So they set a trap for the ghost the next day with Shaggy and Scooby dressing up like a cow, and the ghost goes to wrangle the cow, and Shaggy uses the gun when the head comes off of the cow, and then it turns out that the gun is full of blanks, but it does the job of startling the horse, who bucks off its rider.
Okay.
They were able to do the classic mask pull to find that, gasp, Harriet was the culprit the whole time.
Hmm.
She was tired of cleaning up after all the men.
Okay, that's funny.
And she was trying to drive them out of town with the ghost.
That's fucking funny.
And the Native American man shows back up with their missing cattle because he was not the culprit. But he was just from the neighboring tribe and he was returning the cattle that had wandered into their tribal land.
Oh my God. Like, I love the twist about the villain. That's so good.
And then we get Scooby riding the black horse into the sunset, of course.
Okay.
So the second story is called Yankee Doodle Danger. And it was written by John Rossum, art by Fabio Laguna, lettered by Sal Cipriano, colors by Dave Tanguay, edited by Harvey Richards, cover by Vincent DePorter.
All right.
This story was about a town mayor in a New England town that had called the kids of the mystery machine to solve an issue that they had. Because they were a tourist town, and each year they had just beaches full of tourists, but the last few years, nobody would show up because a huge monster was coming out of the fireworks display and was like legitimately like blowing up ships, like laser eyes blowing up ships. And everyone's like, fuck off. I'm not doing this. This is not the way I'm spending my vacation. And so the creator of the fireworks mentions he's on all kinds of shows for the White House, for all of these other people. It's damaging his career.
Yeah.
And we also find out that there are a couple of fishy characters dressed like red coats, the ghosts of red coats that have been seen in years past. So the team end up searching around. They find the red coats trying to sneak onto a ship, and they figure out that the mayor and the fireworks creator have been sabotaging the display on purpose in order to get the fireworks guy a storefront or something in town. Like that was
okay.
Supposed to help
I don't
somehow.
Understand
I don't
that,
know.
But all right.
I don't either. I was, and maybe I'm missing something. I'm very well be maybe missing something, but In the process, Shaggy and Scooby, of course, set off the display because they like light a match. Because nobody has like just a light a match in a room with all the fireworks, right? And of course, Scooby's face appears in the sky with Fred going, "How did he even do that?"
Okay, I like that though. Like, that's cute.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this comic was fun and silly. It was the standard non-serious crime solving that, you know, we all love about these characters.
Yeah.
The art was great. I mean, it was classic, very much of the cartoon genre.
Oh, so it looks like the Hanna-Barbera cartoons?
Yeah.
Nice.
It's very much. Okay. Yeah, it's very classic. And I do, this is something I just absolutely love. I love when they change the genre of the kids' clothes, but they still have them in the same color scheme.
That's great.
That cracks my shit up.
Yeah.
It was so funny. It was very well done.
Yeah.
I have to say, though, I was not a fan of Scooby's use of a shortened and very offensive version of the word Indian.
Mm-hmm.
Like, 2017.
Yeah.
Come the fuck on.
That's weird, man. I'm actually really surprised by that.
Yeah, I had to double check because I looked at the date before I started reading it. And then I got to that point and I was like, wait. What? I thought this was, I was like, maybe I misread it and it was 2007.
Yeah, but it was 2017.
Right? Which would have made a little bit more sense, but no.
Yeah, no, this was like, that. This was during that span of time when DC was doing a bunch of stuff with like Hanna-Barbera and also Warner Brothers properties, which I think Warner Brothers owns Scooby-Doo, because they also were doing like the Flintstones. They did a Jetsons comic. They did, I think there was a Space Ghost. There was like a bunch of Looney Tunes stuff. Like there was a really solid Batman Elmer Fudd crossover where the whole thing is that it's like established characters like Bugs or Daffy, but what it is they're like monikers. And so they're just people with very exaggerated features.
Okay.
And then Elmer Fudd is effectively a hitman who just has like kind of a hunter motif. And it's a really good little one-shot noir story. I liked it a lot.
See, when you first said that, my brain automatically was like, wow, Batman is going after poachers now. Okay.
That was good. There was a series that I was collecting for a while called Scooby Apocalypse that was pretty good. And I got tired of it eventually, but the whole thing was that basically the apocalypse somehow happens and most of humanity becomes monsters. And then it's like Velma is a super scientist, Daphne is a reporter, and I think Fred was her cameraman. Or maybe it was Shaggy was the cameraman, but Scooby was like a genetic experiment to like enhance dog intelligence.
Oh my goodness, that was very funny.
It was really fun for a while, and then it just kind of felt a little samey after a bit. But I got a blank cover, and I actually had our friend Tom Bayland do a custom cover for it. So it's actually
that was
like
the one you did.
Yeah.
Okay, I remember you dropping. I think that was one of the ones you dropped off at Lumicon, right?
Yeah.
At one point. Yeah. I remember you doing that. Nice.
Yeah. Anytime I have an opportunity for Tom Bayland artwork on a comic, I'm down. So.
I know I've got one of his covers too. I didn't commission it. It was one of the ones he had set up and I was just like, I have to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've easily got like a dozen covers of his at this point.
He's so talented.
Yeah.
I ran into him at Aromas the other day and he was doing his little sketches. He's so good.
Yeah.
So, well, folks, I do believe that is it for this week. So next week we'll have a deep dive about something. Couldn't tell you what.
Yeah.
It's a mystery, as the kids would say.
Yeah.
We'll solve it next week for you.
Maybe.
But after that, the week of maybe, yeah, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the week after that, we will do another Dollar Bin Discovery. But until then, stay safe out there, and we'll see you in the stacks.
Perfect.
We'll see you for some snacks.
Thanks for listening to 10 Cent Takes. Accessibility is important to us, so text transcriptions of each of our published episodes can be found on our website.
This episode was hosted by Jessica Fraser and Mike Thompson, written by Jessica Fraser and edited by Mike Thompson. Our intro theme was written and performed by Jared Emerson Johnson of Bay Area Sound. Our credits and transition music is Pursuit of Life by Evan MacDonald and was purchased with a standard license from Premium Beat. Our banner graphics were designed by Sarah Frank, who's at lookmomdraws.com.
If you'd like to get in touch with us, ask us questions, or tell us about how we got something wrong, please head over to 10centtakes.com or shoot an email to 10centtakes@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter for now. The official podcast account is 10 Cent Takes, all one word. Jessica is Jessica with a, and Jessica is spelled with a K. And Mike is Vansau, V-A-N-S-A-U. You can also find us on Instagram, Mastodon, Facebook, TikTok, and Blue Sky. A full list of our socials will be listed in the show notes.
You can also send us mail now. We are at P.O. Box 940 in Pen Grove, California, 94951. And Pen Grove is spelled P-E-N-N-G-R-O-V-E.
Send us stuff.
If you'd like to support us, be sure to download, rate, and review wherever you listen.
Stay safe out there.
And support your local comic shop.